Now, two parts of this we begin with, namely these, and that's the operant. An operant is a behavior that has an effect on the environment. So it clearly corresponds to performance achievement. And as we just developed here, you're going to have two general kinds of contingencies of reinforcement, both of which are necessary. That will correspond to K and W. Stimulant. And it's not clear whether he would call this a stimulus, a class of stimulus, or just a condition, like a condition of deprivation or whatever. So two major categories of controlling variables will fill the values of K and W.
Is that because the K parameter, because the person would be distinguishing between when the contingencies are there and not?
Yeah. See, the K one is distinguishing when the contingency is there. The W one distinguishes when that contingency is reinforcing. Now, what do we have that corresponds to KH?
It would have to be the behavior because that
expresses. No, KH can't be behavior. It has to be. Remember the definition and the nature of the values of this parameter. The function of KH is to prevent P from being accidental. P has to be an expression of competence. You specify values of K by specifying learning episodes that make the occurrence here non-accidental. No, that's too narrow. The process of conditioning itself is the set of learning episodes that make the occurrence of the operant non-accidental. What? Remember, in the explication of this, I said the function of K is to eliminate as behavior things which are merely accidental chance. The performance is the expression of competence. The values of KH are given by specifying earlier states of affairs, so formally states of affairs, which are the learning episodes which make this behavior non-accidental. By referring these behaviors to those learning episodes that you show them to be non-accidental. But that's exactly what we call conditioning over here. So it's the process of conditioning or the conditioning history that gives you the values of the KH parameter. Now, let's look at it the other way. What is in these notions that isn't in there? So you remember, each time we found something in the theoretical notion that isn't in intentional action, and in both times, there has been a reference to something physiological that's left over. In Allport, there was something non-physiological. What about here? What's left over looking at? I guess we've covered everything except shaping behavior. So if you delete that one from the list, what kind of things are contained in those that are not subsumable under either the notion of intentional action itself or the values of those parameters?
That would be true.
Well, I haven't mentioned determinism, have I? I didn't put that one down on the board. So let's leave that for the time being.
You couldn't get determinism out of looking at all those other things and saying, you know, it seems like it's something you could lift up from even those things that are there. It's certainly the notion of choice certainly isn't there.
Yeah. Well, notion of choice isn't there either. Well, I'll tell you what, let's diagram it. Is, remember, we had an independent formulation of trait and instinct for comparison purposes. We haven't yet done that here. Let's try the diagram. Here we have the... You have the response which has an effect on the environment. And then you have controlling variables some number of them. And you have a history of conditioning which involves selective reinforcement. The history of conditioning explains how come these controlling variables are controlling variables for that operand. You have a conditioned operant when you have this kind of arrangement, namely a set of controlling variables which reliably elicit a respondent. But only if you got them via that kind of history. Because remember, the respondent was, or the operant was contrasted to the respondent, in which also you had a set of stimuli that reliably elicited the response. So you wind up with the same kind of pattern with operant conditioning, except now you specify that you got that pattern from a certain kind of history, namely operant conditioning and not Pavlovian conditioning. So under the heading conditioning, we have these other notions of selective reinforcement, and that is necessarily there. Generalization is necessarily there. However, saying it's necessarily there is harmless because you don't say how much of it is there and how much may be zero. Extinction may or may not have been there. Discrimination, you presuppose, is there. Otherwise, you couldn't have selective reinforcement. So you can improve discrimination, but you assume there's some there. So, like with generalization, you know it's there, but you don't know how much. You allow yourself wide leeway as to how much is possible. Okay, so these other notions are part of the history here. They are the kinds of things that might be found in that history. But the result of that history is this. Now, we've seen that the correspondence here, this is these. We said this set necessarily divides into at least two categories, which correspond to these two. And the history taken as a whole corresponds to this. But at this point, you can see that there's a lot more specification possible here. There's none even suggested here. And you say, well, if could you represent this kind of thing? If not by simply specifying this parameter, how would you specify this kind of thing? And you go back to how we would specify a chess game. Namely, as participation in a set of social practices. And if you have an experimenter conditioning a pigeon, it's obviously that's a social practice, which has a certain kind of structure, certain contingencies, eligibilities, etc. And it's as a result of participating in that practice that the pigeon comes to do what he does. And with children and adults, again, it's the same story. So if you wanted to specify the learning history, you would specify some set of episodes which have a social practice and or relationship type structure. And we saw with Gloria that where you don't have a social practice structure, you will have a relationship structure. That is, people will be acting in terms of the relations they have, even if they're not engaging in visibly in social practices. But also that the reason they're not visibly engaging in social practices is they never finish them. They're always just making move on. So again, you see, you can allow yourself to say they are always engaging in social practices, since each single behavior is a participation. Or you can say, no, they're not, because the practices don't finish, but they are acting in terms of relationship. Anyhow, you can see that when it comes to the elaboration of this, the entire resources of the system are available for describing a history, whereas they're kind of built in here. But if you set yourself to do it on the model of Fitz and Gloria, you could diagram what goes on when somebody gets selectively reinforced, or when he gets extinguished, or when he generalizes, or other such things. So there's no specification here, but somewhere you know you can do it. Here there is implicitly, because these enter into the explication of conditioning. Aside from that, there is a fairly clear correspondence, with one major exception, and that is that this formula is of this sort, whereas that one is not. This is a cause-effect relation between this side and that side, whereas over here there is not a cause-effect relation between the left side and the right side. So as with instinct and with the trait, you see that in terms of the nitty-gritty, the kinds of information that you're dealing with, you've got the same set of distinctions, but there is here, as in the other ones, something importantly different there and here, as well as the limitations here. Recall I've talked several times about the difference between what you can allow as a stimulus and what will qualify as a value of K. So again, you can say it's the same kind of distinction, but you don't have the same range of possibility here that you do there. Now, in fact, operant conditioners have been very liberal about what they are willing to call a stimulus or a controlling variable. Recall I said that it's standard practice that in order for something to be a stimulus, it has to be something then and there present. And that when I ask about Eve in the Garden of Eden, since those Eve and the Garden of Eden are not here and now present, they can't be stimuli. But they can certainly be values of K. In operant conditioning, you have something in between. Skinner, for example, in writing the book on verbal behavior, will allow something like this. Here is a verbal behavior of saying the boy runs the store. See, and if you ask what are the controlling variables or what's the stimulus conditions for this thing, he says, well, it's a complicated set of stimulus conditions. Namely, those. Well, you can see that if you're willing to do this, you are not restricting yourself to something that is here, now present. But at the same time, you probably are not going to allow as much as you could here, because here there's no restriction, whatever. And even with this kind of liberalization, it doesn't look like you'd get everything there, and probably Skinner wouldn't include everything. But you can see that this is a far cry from something that is here now present. It's a far cry from wavelengths and sound intensities, or visual stimulus patterns.
Does calling that controlling variables mean that those concepts were at one time reinforced positively so that they are then within the range of behaviors that would occur now? I'm trying to fit what you're calling controlling variables into the whole schema and asking whether saying that those are controlling variables means at one time they were stimuli, which, or were responses which were conditioned.
So here's the response. This is the controlling variables.
I don't understand how they're related, but I don't understand why you're calling them controlling variables.
Well, I don't. Skinner does. And this is an actual example.
Can you explain to me why Skinner would do that?
Yeah. Because there's nothing else that could serve as a controlling variable. See, this is his equivalent of functional stimuli being functional equivalent. He says some pattern such that what it amounts to is this. And this is the direct, intelligible way of specifying what the condition is under which saying this either is or has been reinforced. And at this level of description, in these terms, you can argue that indeed, people get selectively reinforced for saying that things are so, if, in fact, those things are so. Because I get reinforced for saying it's a chair if it's a chair, but not if it's an elephant. So it's being a chair is the conditions under which my saying it's a chair will, it's plausible that there's a differential reinforcement. And therefore, it's being a chair or the boy running a store is plausible as the controlling variable for this kind of response. Now, in his account, his actual account, there's a heavy reliance on generalization. Because you can see that I could say this under these conditions, even if I had never said it under those conditions. Even if I had never encountered that condition, when I encountered it, I might say this first time out. And you couldn't explain that by saying, well, I got reinforced for saying this under these conditions. You'd have to say, I was reinforced for doing something similar to this under conditions which were similar to that. So you would hardly call this illuminating. In fact, you might call it laughable. But formally, that's the framework within, and that's how you would handle it. Language is probably the kind of thing that operant conditioning handles worst. It is a lot more plausible and compelling with other kinds of behavior than verbal behavior.
You know, the what conditions must the stimuli be present?
None. There's nothing in the theory that says that any stimuli ever has to be present.
For reinforcement.
Same answer. This theory is couched in terms of when behavior is reinforced in the presence of stimuli then. It doesn't have anything to say about when those stimuli are present.
It doesn't even have to be visible. Self-reinforcement.
Right. It's just not couched in terms of when a stimuli has to be present. It's couched in terms of if there is a stimuli.
When you say that Skinner talks about the world, the stories, and control environment, is he saying that control environment?
Well, I think what he says, it's a stimulus configuration that operates as a controlling variable. Or that this behavior is under the control of a stimulus configuration, which is this.
Yeah, what I want to know is what is Skinner call a stimulus configuration? We call it a fact.
Calls it a stimulus configuration.
But I'm not clear yet what he's talking about.
Neither is he. See, this is his theoretical language, that it's a stimulus configuration, but there is no way to specify that stimulus configuration any more than there's a way to specify the stimulus configuration for a chair. So he has to engage in the same kind of maneuver. Namely, to say that it is a stimulus configuration, but identify it not by reference to what stimuli are there, but by reference to something else that is recognizable, which is this.
So he's trying to use that word. People want to say, well, that's not, you're not present. Because he's not saying it's not,
present. It's open enough so that he can go either way.
Right. But he doesn't ever come out and say, well, these are facts that.
No. See, what happens is that nobody who wants to object is going to object because this is not here, not present. What they do is look at that and laugh. And you can see why, too. See, it's very much like a homunculus explanation. But in effect, it's an act of faith, just as the trait notion, that someday we will be able to show you what the stimuli are. But we already know that there has to be something of that sort, and so let's not get hung up on details like that. Let's start with what we know and move on.
I'm wondering even how he writes the sentence when he said that, because you've been pointing to before, when he writes it in a paragraph or a page, does he say this thing's configuration is the what that word writes the scheme?
Oh.
No. How that word is in that? Does he use a pointer?
No. It's in a sentence, and it's in the book called Verbal Behavior. And my best recollection of the actual dialogue is he says the behavior is under the control of an extremely complex and subtle stimulus configuration, which consists of the boy running the store.
Boy running the store. Yeah. Explain some sort of nonsense sentence in terms of the hippopotamus flies. Okay. Is that okay? Then you're dealing with some sort of idea of a hippopotamus fly.
We're dealing with a piece of verbal behavior that, whether we know the specifics or not, is under some controlling variable. We just don't happen to know which. See, that's like Freud saying, well, there is some instinct at work, there is some source, there is some object that you're affecting when you say that, but we don't know which.
And what if I...
It's like Allport saying, well, there's some trait there at work, and we may not know which, but we know that there is one.
Are ideas just internal or verbal behavior?
For operant conditioning, there is no such thing as idea. Idea is too much like spirit and soul. And if you read Skinner, he's very concerned about spirits and souls.
Well, how would it just doesn't exist?
That's right. It's a bad piece of verbal behavior that doesn't correspond to anything real. It's a superstition.
So he could be something that subvocal behaves. Subvocal speech or something. Wait. Okay, you just wouldn't say that it does not exist.
He wouldn't say the behavior doesn't exist. He wouldn't say, you didn't say flying hippopotamuses. He would say that's a piece of verbal behavior that is under the control of some variables that we don't know what the variables are.
Okay, how about thinking?
Well, until you have something that you can see that is behavior, you would say thinking is just a word, a part of our verbal repertoire that we've been reinforced for using. But there's nothing real that corresponds to thinking. Or he would make a move like with a motivation. It's just a word that connects a lot of antecedent conditions in a bundle to a lot of consequent conditions in a bundle. And it's useful to have that kind of term, but don't mistake it as the name of anything. It doesn't refer to anything real. And he would take the tact that he is under no more obligation to account for thinking than he is to account for the Oedipus complex. That unless it's real, it's somebody's invention and not something that an honest-to-God theory has to account for. And whereas it's not hard to object to certain moves of this sort, it's awfully hard to argue with somebody who argues that way. So you might call a non-negotiable stance.
What was the meaning behind Chomsky's rebuttal?
Hmm? It's not so much a rebuttal as a kind of a up and down critique about whether an approach like Skinner's could possibly help us understand verbal behavior. And his answer was no way. And he picks some of it. I think he may have picked this example in his review, too. In fact, I have a number of copies of that review. I'll hand out some. Because it's one of the better ones, not just for accounting for language behavior, but for what one might find objectionable in a deterministic stimulus response theory. So if I have as many as 15 of those left, which I'm pretty sure I do, I'll just bring them in. You can grab them if you're interested in that. Okay, well, again, part of the moral is, no matter how you slice it, it always comes out this way. That you can talk about it in different terms, but if you look closely and know what you're looking for, like in that mystery picture, you'll see it. And so, having seen what you can do with this, once you see that you've got a formulation that carries the same distinctions, subject to how much of a limitation there is, like up here, you know that anything you can do with this, you're going to be able to do, there's going to be some translation over here that you can do it in these terms too. But again, because of the limitations in generality or of particular form like this, you'll see those limitations showing up somewhere. And one of the places where it shows up, as in most of these theories, is in self-knowledge again. How would you represent the fact of self-knowledge in these terms? See, Skinner wouldn't want to talk about self-knowledge, but if you did and wanted to use this theory, how could you do it? Well, you'd pretty much have to talk about internal operations, internal behaviors. To talk about your external behaviors being the controlling stimuli for internal behaviors, which in turn can be the controlling stimuli for external behaviors. And so this kind of extension then leads you to talk about internal behavior and self-reinforcement. You can see that those notions formally are an extension of the notions of visible behavior and reinforcement. Now, you might worry about what kind of extensions they are. Because whereas the notion of a reinforcement, say, is quite intelligible, what would a self-reinforcement be? You refer to self-reinforcement when there isn't any obvious reinforcement. So self-reinforcement comes to look a lot like non-reinforcement. Non-reinforcement which acts like reinforcement.
A self-reinforcement isn't a reinforcement by a person to oneself, and there could be behavior that's observable. That's not what you mean?
No, because if it's observable, it's just like any other reinforcement. It's when I do something and praise myself silently. Then you have to say, well, he did it in his head. It was an internal behavior. And similarly, in accounting for verbal behavior, Skinner had to introduce internal behaviors like editing and composing. Circular, but again, remember, one of the important things about a theory is to give you conceptual forms that give you access to phenomena. And if it takes talking about self-reinforcement to give you access to the phenomena that sometimes when a person just thinks he's done well, that's good enough, then you do it in terms of self-reinforcement. See, it's better than pretending there's no such phenomena, because there's no corresponding thing in the theory. Well, that way. You can use the self-reinforcement to generate thinking as a derivative, rather than thinking to generate self-reinforcement. Or you can introduce internal behaviors, like composing, like editing, and those will be your mental processes, and that's thinking. And Skinner does that with the verbal behavior. Well, as I said, you can see that by making these formal moves, you have access to other facts. As you facilitate your access to other facts, and that's better than denying that they're there because there's no place for them in your theory. On the other hand, if you're taking a certain attitude toward the theory, if you're thinking of the theory as informative or something like that, then you're liable to be disappointed. And you're liable to say, well, there's more than just a formal move here. Saying that you have a new kind of reinforcement, namely self-reinforcement, is like saying we've got a new species of wolf, namely an imaginary wolf. No, that just doesn't work. An imaginary wolf isn't a species of wolf, and self-reinforcement just isn't a kind of reinforcement. And the extension of that is because it doesn't have the same parameters. Remember, we went through what defines things as being of different kinds logically is that they have different parameters. Imaginary wolves don't have the same parameters as real wolves. And you can ask yourself, to what extent does self-reinforcement have the same parameters as reinforcement? And you're going to come out with an in-between answer. It's not as clear as real wolves and imaginary wolves, but neither is it as clear as tables and chairs. Somewhere in between. Okay, I think we better stop now because next time, we'll look at the shaping behavior as that portion of Skinner's theory which primarily deals with the history, the longitudinal, and therefore corresponds to the developmental schema, the way in which this corresponds to intentional action. The other thing, I want you to read in that chapter that clinical example. And that clinical example, I think, is spread out over three different places in the chapter. The example of the soldier who deserts the front lines and has a hysterical paralysis of the arm. And you wind up with a statement to the effect that the fact that he behaves in the way he does follows from the theory. I want you to operate as critics and ask yourself, does it follow from the theory? To examine that question, you have to reconstruct the entire account in operant terms of what happened with that soldier. So do those two things.
Okay, as usual, the easiest way to explain the notion of shaping behavior is to go to an experimental paradigm. And it's one that I think we almost have before. That's where you have a box with a pigeon in it and a red dot on the wall. And what you want to do is get the pigeon to peck the red dot. So far, the analysis of reinforcement that we've had said, if he pecks the dot and you reinforce him for it, that's going to increase the likelihood. And if you keep that up, eventually you'll be pecking it pretty regularly. You look at that and you say, but he's got to peck it first. Otherwise, you can't reinforce him for that. And you put a pigeon in there and you find that he doesn't peck. What he does is he pecks it out there. So at this point, the stage is set for the procedure, which is a paradigm for shaping behavior. Because what happens is, if you look at the area on the floor, you find that if left to his own devices, the pigeon will peck in a certain range and with a certain frequency. It might just invent a normal curve to represent the frequency. And it has some central tendency. So suppose that's the picture of what's going on here. If that's the central tendency. What you do now is you start selectively reinforcing. And you reinforce him for pecking on this half of his distribution. You do not reinforce him for pecking in that half of the distribution. So this diagram, if you draw a line here, you say you reinforce these, you don't reinforce those. Now, you might expect that what would happen then is that these would drop off and that the rest would remain. In fact, that's not what happens. What happens is that you get a new curve with a new central tendency that is in that direction. And what happens as a result of that is he is now picking in places that he wouldn't have before. So you catch him, this is at T1. You catch him at a later time, and now you see a different distribution characterized by that different central tendency. You don't recycle and say, okay, I'm going to only reinforce this side, and I'm going to stop reinforcing all of these. And so here you now divide this in half. Reinforce these, but not these. So, you now get a new distribution, and it is in this direction. So, now coming out here. Now you can see that by just recycling this, what it does is it's packing more and more over here. And if it gets close enough, will start pecking the wall. And each time, as soon as he stabilizes, you just do the same procedure. You reinforce the responses that are in the direction that you eventually want. You don't reinforce the responses that are in the opposite direction, and his central tendency will move in the direction that you want. If you do this long enough and don't do it wrong and don't get unlucky, he eventually pecks the red dot. At that point, the other paradigm takes over. You start reinforcing that and not something else, and after a while, he's pecking the red dot. Now, this whole sequence is a paradigm for shaping behavior. If you ask why shaping, the answer is, well, that's just a word they picked. Here's the real paradigm. If you say, well, they weren't just picking at random, then you say, well, yeah. What happens when you shape something is that you adjust it in small ways until it eventually is what you want. And that's the kind of thing that is going on here. You adjust it in small ways until it reaches what you want it to be. Now, if you then step back and look at it, you say, hey, here's a handy-dandy method of starting with almost any behavior and winding up with almost any behavior. So long as there's some connection, some route, some path, some dimension of similarity, you can work this procedure. Now, this is not to say that you're guaranteed that the procedure will succeed. It's only that as long as you can see some pathway from the behavior he is doing to the behavior you want, you can try that pathway and selectively reinforce. And it won't be too long before you'll find out whether indeed you can move him on that path or not. And if one pathway won't work, gee, maybe there's another one that will. Now, one of the more dramatic aspects of this is how short a time it takes. I think it's a common colloquium type demonstration for an operant conditioner to walk in with a pigeon in the box and just set the thing into operation at the beginning of his lecture, and then in about half an hour, 15 minutes or something like that, the pigeon is pecking the box. And that's surprising because you couldn't have said in advance of this kind of experience that it would only take that long, that you could achieve that kind of effect that quickly. So with these kinds of experimental paradigms, see, you get some promise of very efficient ways of changing what people do, starting with almost anything that they're already doing. And that's one of its major attractions. So if we come back to the developmental schema, says you acquire a given ID characteristic by having the prior capacity and the right kind of intervening history. I said that there's no time interval specified. You can pick any interval you want. The only limitation is over how short a distance can you detect an ID difference. Well, what you'll find is that this unit is the general form for this cycle that you're using over here in selectively reinforcing so as to shape behavior. And the ID characteristic in question, there's various ways of formulating. The easiest way is to say it's the central tendency here. The central tendency expresses the pigeon's trait, or in general, his disposition to peck. And there is a central tendency, and the central tendency does change. And if it didn't, you wouldn't get that effect. So what you've got there is an ID characteristic of a central tendency for emitting behaviors, as the saying goes. And that is what changes, and that is what fits these positions in this logical unit. And from the outside, as I say, the trick is to figure out a pathway along which you are going to generate change. Now, once you have it over here, you can see, since there is no constraint on what sorts of characteristics a person may acquire. At least not too many that we know of. And we don't know of many strong constraints on what you have to be like here in order to be a certain way over here. Indeed, there is that potential for almost any kind of behavior tendency at one time may result in a very different kind of behavior tendency at a different time if you pick the right kind of history. That's what you see in simplified form here, in saying if you can find a path and provide a history of this general sort, then that may be a path to get from where he is to where you want to begin. Now, no more than in this diagram does this operant conditioning notion tell you which are the paths and which are not. It simply gives you a framework and the idea of there being such pathways, and then you have to find out empirically which things will lead to which and which will not. So just as the notion of a conditioned operant essentially is a redo of this, the historical developmental aspect, namely shaping behavior, is a limited version of this. Putting it in the form of the emission of behaviors and selective reinforcement does not enable you to get at all of the possibilities that this one does. It's not that there's some possibilities that you can't talk at all about in these terms. It's that these terms will not get at all of the facts that might be present in human learning. For example, one of the things that it is not really there in the theory is the notion of an ID characteristic itself. Skinner explicitly disavows any necessity to deal with any ID characteristics. Okay, look, taking in terms of here. At T1, you have a central tendency for pecking in a certain place. That central tendency is your ID characteristic here, which gives you the capacity to acquire a new one, given the right kind of history.
So T2 would be
the right kind of history is the selective reinforcement here. By virtue of this history that at a later time, you have a new central tendency. So the history corresponds to the behavior. The new central tendency corresponds to the new ID characteristic that you acquired by virtue of that history, given your prior characteristic. Again, notice that what you lose here is all of the distinctions, not merely of ID characteristics generally, but the differences between traits, attitudes, interests, styles, etc. You lose all of those internal distinctions.
How does this Skinnerian paradigm deal with what you might call constitutional abilities? It's not a human don't peck like a pigeon. So you could reinforce something for a really long time, shape his behavior, and you still may not get authentic pecking.
Well, that's why part of the task is there a route from here to there? And if there is one, then by selective reinforcement, you ought to be able to move. Now, if you try it, like if you try selectively reinforcing your own being to say peck at that picture up there on the blackboard, and you've been at it for 6 months and it's not working, what do you say? Well, you say, either I have picked the wrong stimulus dimension or the wrong response dimension to selectively reinforce, or the what I thought was reinforcing isn't. In effect, you take your paradigm of the successful shaping of behavior and you look at every one of the parameters and you say, maybe that's where it's gone on. That's a standard way of accounting for negative results.
So there's no real notion of inherently impossible tasks?
No. There, again, it's not informative that way. It doesn't tell you which are possible or impossible any more than it tells you which are feasible, which are not. Remember that for the use of any of these theories, you have an implicit framework, namely either a theorist or an experimenter here, and a real world within which he operates on certain things that he describes in ordinary language. And then somewhere in that picture are certain facts that he directly formulates in theoretical terms. And in this case, what we get is the experimenter saying to another experimenter in ordinary language, I guess I haven't found the right way to reinforce him. But you can't say that here in the theory. So that's something that goes informally with the theory because it's not stateable within the theory. And that too contrasts with our AOC, all of which is part of the thing. And you simply plug the experimenter here, you plug him in here, and you plug him in here. He says of himself, I guess I wasn't using the right reinforcement. Or conversely, he says, I guess that he didn't have the right characteristic to learn from that kind of reinforcement. Over here you say, I guess he didn't have the capacity to learn arithmetic with a standard procedure. Let me mention something in passing. One of the contributions of this whole approach is an interesting set of findings about concerning schedules of reinforcement. If you've got something that occurs rapidly enough for you to count a lot of instances in a finite period of time, what you can do is vary the way in which reinforcement is given and plot that against a response curve. And that's where you get some interesting findings, because you can imagine a variety of patterns of reinforcement, beginning with the differences between the three kinds of reinforcement that we distinguished, and then continuing to, well, you give a reinforcement every nth time that you have the right response. For example, on this pigeon thing, you can reinforce him every time, or every other time, or every third time, or every tenth time, or whatever ratio you want. And you get a nice family of curves that depend on the ratio. Or you can say, I'm going to reinforce this organism every 20 seconds, no matter what he does. You get another interesting set of curves that are a function of what the period of time was. And then you can contrast reinforcing at regular intervals, like every 20 seconds, versus reinforcing at irregular intervals. You get one of the most interesting findings, namely that with irregular reinforcement, you get a lot of resistance to extinction. And then you, if you're imaginative enough, you apply this directly to things like, why do people play slot machines, knowing that the odds are against them? The answer is because every now and then you hit the jackpot. That's enough to keep you going, and that fits formally the definition of irregular or aperiodic reinforcement. So you use that kind of laboratory finding to explain this interesting real-life phenomenon. Now, the schedule of reinforcement is one of the things that you would be thinking about if you're having trouble shaping behavior. One of your first options is, let's try another schedule, maybe a different schedule. And you have that available because there are already a lot of research done
with a fair variety of species that give you a good deal of regularity in producing different curves, different response curves, as a function of different patterns of reinforcement. So since you know that over a wide range of individuals and situations, differences in response curves are a function of differences in reinforcement patterns, whenever you're stuck, that's one of your options. It's one of your first options. Now, that aspect of it is more involved in practical use than in what you might call the personality theory aspect of it. So unless you have a special interest in it, I'm just going to point out that that is a feature of this approach and go on to something else. An operant condition will not talk about impulse control, it will simply talk about control of behavior. On the other hand, practically speaking, in some cases of impulse control, he will use punishment on. Other cases, punishment. Other cases, he'll simply positively reinforce any productive alternative. So for example, if your kid makes noise in a classroom, and you want him to stop, one way to at least try is to ignore him when he steps out of line and to pay attention to him when he does something legitimate. Another is to take him out of the room immediately and put him in a separate room. And you can consider that punishment, he probably does, or you can consider it something else. But it's a different procedure than just ignoring him. Or you can start him beginning of the day with 20 M&Ms and take one away from him whenever he does that. And that would fit the punishment paradigm. There's an easy mnemonic for remembering the basic three kinds of reinforcement that are distinguished. Unfortunately, it's also rather polemic. Keep that in mind. The basic three kinds, the positive, negative, and punishment, will correspond to what down through the ages have been known as bribery, extortion, and blackmail. That you bribe somebody when you make it worth his while to do something he wouldn't have done if you hadn't made it worth his while. You blackmail somebody if you say to him, unless you do X, I'm going to cream you. You're going to do something that you really would rather avoid. And you're pulling extortion when you take something from him that you values, that he values, and say to him, I won't give it back to you unless you do what I want. So if you present somebody with an aversive stimulus and then say, if you do what I want, I'll take this away, that's the extortion pattern. If you put a person in a situation where if he does the thing that he'd be inclined to do, you follow it by a zap, that's the blackmail pattern. And if you give him something he wants, if he does what you want, that's the bribery.
Which ones do these correspond
to? These are the three types of reinforcement that
we correspond to which.
A bribery is the positive reinforcement.
That one.
Okay. Now, the negative reinforcement, as I defined it, namely a reinforcement which decreases the likelihood, is blackmail. Punishment, the stimulus whose cessation is positive reinforcing is extortion.
Can you just repeat what you said?
Yeah, see, remember in blackmail, you say, unless you do X, you're going to get zapped.
And
so he does X in order to avoid getting zapped.
And has that extortion?
in extortion, you zap him first and then say, I'll stop zapping you if you do what I want. See, remember, the common pattern of extortion is to kidnap the banker's wife and say to him, you can have her back alive and unharmed if you pay me $20,000. Whereas in blackmail, you mail the guy an incriminating photograph and say, unless you pay me $20,000, I'm going to send this to the newspaper. So these differential categories of reinforcement have been known for a long, long time. They were known to the Greeks, they were known to Machiavelli, they've been known to every government and every tyrant that has ever lived, and to a lot of other people too. Because of that kind of connection, you can see that if you formulate this three-way categorization of types of reinforcement, you can use selective reinforcement in all of the ways that people have used bribery, blackmail, and extortion to get other people to do what they want. And as is well known, these are powerful methods for getting people to do what you want.
This is about the varying schedules of reinforcement. I see how that clearly works with positive reinforcement. How would you go about varying schedules type for punishment? Occasionally stopping?
Yeah. Oh, I see. Yeah. And it has to be weak punishment if you're going to do that, but it can be done.
And in that case, too, that kind of schedule with punishment leads to poor extinction. That can, it's clear, and when you talk about positive reinforcement, that that schedule would just do it. Does it hold for the other kind
of thing? Something like that holds for negative. I'm not sure about punishment because they don't tend to do that kind of experiment. But think of a situation where a kid is doing something and occasionally you zap him. That will have an effect. And if you zap him once in 50 times, it has less of an effect than if you zap him once in every 3 times. And you don't get only 1/3 as much effect if you zap him every 3 times than if you zap him every time. And he will avoid longer if you zap him every 3 times than if you zap him every time. Now, if that seems counterintuitive, just put it again in human terms and say, if you're zapping him every time, then when you stop zapping him, he finds that out very quickly. And therefore, as soon as he finds that out, his behavior will change. Whereas if you're zapping him periodically, and particularly if you're doing it irregularly, you're going to have to go a long time before he has enough information to conclude that, in fact, you have stopped. And so you would indeed expect that with aperiodic reinforcement, you would get harder extinction. Anything else on schedules? Okay, let's come back to the issue of causality and ID characteristics, because they're connected in this theory. One of the major reasons why Skinner avoids any talk of ID characteristic, he makes quite explicit, and that is he's interested in this paradigm, and he's interested in phenomena that he real live experimenter can control directly. And you recall I said that is the basic use of cause-effect theories or cause-effect descriptions. Cause-effect description is of some value if you can produce that cause. B Because if you can, then you can produce that effect. And this is what Skinner is explicitly interested in. What variables can a experimenter manipulate in order to produce behavioral effects? Now, one of the things you can't directly manipulate is ID characteristics. You can take them into account in what you do, but you can't just change them the way you can change a stimulus, the way you can manipulate the value of some variable. So, from this motivation, you have a theory, if one can call it that, in which there is no mention of ID characteristics, and which is purely causal. Now, you'll recall in talking about this diagram, I said this arrow represents a non-causal relation, this arrow represents a causal one. It's the history that causes the new ID characteristic, but the ID characteristic here does not cause the behavior, does not cause the history. So in this diagram, you have a non-causal link here and a causal link there. And it's because of this non-causal link that if you want to have a completely causal account, you can't afford to have ID characteristics. Because ID characteristics do not operate in a causal way.
Does Skinner talk about that particular path which is necessary to get from one behavior to the next, initiative of behavior impairment? He just says it can be done if you do the right direction.
Yeah, what you have is general statements that behaviors can be shaped via selective reinforcement, that a given behavior could in principle be shaped, that the behaviors that we see around us have in fact been shaped. But nothing as, you know, about pathways and the fact that on a given pathway you may fail, where on another pathway you may succeed. That kind of thing is implicit in the generalization gradients that we do.
Pete, when you have certain type of characteristics, you behave in the way. And so that doesn't that influence someone's history? I'm saying that
for circumstances and ID characteristics both are necessary to account for behavior. It isn't that if you have certain ID characteristics, you behave in a certain way. If you have certain ID characteristics, then in particular situations, you behave in particular ways.
If you like, okay, you say what? There's two variables.
Yeah.
One is circumstances, one is ID.
Right.
Okay. And now the circumstances are the same. You have different ID characteristics.
It may or may not be a different behavior. If you get different behavior and the circumstances are the same, you have to have different ID characteristics.
Somehow it just stands out in my mind that ID characteristics cause behavior. And the reason being is you can just look around people with certain characteristics and act a certain way. People with other characteristics,
yeah. But not every form of explanation is a causal form. And when you say that this kind of person acts this way and that kind of person acts that way, you also have to act, does being that kind of person cause him to act that way? And the answer is no. That's not how ID characteristics enter into the explanation of behavior. And to see why not, you probably need a paradigm of causal explanation. And one of the features of causal explanation is that the task is to explain not merely why something happened, but why it happened when it did. And so you get a behavior here, you get some kind of event. You say, how come it happened? And if you say, how come it happened when it did, you say, because something else happened when it did. Give you an example. Suppose there was a little hole in the blackboard here, and I held this piece of chalk here and then tapped it and it went in. Its going in would be the behavior of the chalk in question. You say, how come the chalk went in? Because I tapped it. And it's because I tapped it when I did that it went in when it did. And so the tap takes care of a certain part of what goes on. On the other hand, you say, well, but why did the chalk go in when you tapped it? Considering that if it had been an eraser that you held there and tapped it, it wouldn't have gone in. That's where you appeal to the ID characters. You say, well, the chalk went in when I tapped it because it's round and the hole is round and the hole is bigger than the chalk. Now, that's not a causal explanation. It's part of the explanation of what happened, but it's not a causal explanation. So you might say that a causal explanation has to be completed by an ID character, an ID explanation that says how come the thing that you identified as a cause was effective, because under other circumstances, with other sorts of things, the same thing would not have been a cause. It would not have caused this result. So part of your explanation is how come the cause did operate as a cause? And the answer will be given by ID characters. You say, how come that remark caused him to be angry? You say, that's because he's a solemn, hostile guy. A different kind of guy wouldn't have gotten angry at those remarks. So he's being a hostile guy explains his behavior in a way that saying, because I made these caustic remarks, does not explain that to you. You need both ingredients. Because you need to answer not only why.
You see how it is?
You need to explain not only why him, but why then? And the ID characteristic explains why him, and the cause explains why then. And that's what you've got in mind. I said about this being a reconstruction, which when you go backward, you're working logic, but if you want to, you go forward and you think of it as cause-effect. And now you'll see an interesting phenomenon here. You see, okay, if we account for this behavior, we do appeal to circumstances, but we also appeal to ID. However, in explaining the position of the ID, we come back to prior history. And now suppose that somebody wants to say, well, forget this then. Whatever ID characteristic you want to use, you will have to refer it back to some history whereby it was acquired. And now I will use that history as part of the circumstances that causally